In the struggle between we the people and the power elite, what moves the needle toward the former?
It's not that people are poor that gets them mad. It's when they are promised something and then you have that promise is not delivered. That was the Bonus Army, and they demanded fundamentally a different relationship between the government and the people. And when they made this demand, they became a hugely important force in politics. And the Congress in 1931, which was just like really pathetic, it was the Democrats had taken it over, but they were just really pathetic Democrats. But in 1933, they became probably one of the most progressive Congresses ever. And it was a lot of it was the same, sort of the same people. There were a bunch of new members, but they had been persuaded that the government had to have a different relationship to the people and to the corporate world. You know, today we think of the New Deal as, oh, they helped form some unions, or, oh, that was really, you know, the government got bigger. Oh, but they were still racist. And it's like, no, what was happening in the 1930s is there was a gang fight between populists who were afraid of fascism rising all over the world and plutocrats that wanted to keep what they had.
That's Matt Stoller. We talk with him about his book, Goliath, the 100-year war between monopoly power and democracy. Then we replay an excerpt from our interview last year with Thomas Frank about populism, real and fake. He's got a new book out about it, The People Know. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer, Francesca Rhiannon. Americans once had a coherent and clear understanding of political tyranny, a concentration of power, whether in the hands of a military dictator or a J.P. Morgan, was understood as autocratic and dangerous to individual liberty and democracy. In the 1930s, people observed that the Great Depression was caused by financial concentration in the hands of a few whose misuse of their power induced a financial collapse. Matt Stoller's book, Goliath, looks at the struggles over monopoly power and democracy before, during, and since that time, in his book, Goliath. He's also the author of the blog, Big, which examines monopoly in the news, covering topics from big pharma and big tech to sports and podcasting. I spoke with Matthew Stoller about his book, Goliath, several months ago. Matt Stoller, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
You were a congressional staffer working for a member of Congress on the Financial Services Committee during the last financial crisis, the one in 2007-2008. What did that experience show you, and how did it lead to this book?
I like that we have, they're like, which financial crisis was it? It's kind of funny. So I worked during the bailouts. I was trying to deal with, I was working in Congress, and I was looking at how the financial system worked and foreclosures, and it was during a crisis, and what characterized that crisis is that nobody knew what was going on. And it was like, today there seems to be a lot more fluency around banking and finance, and people understand that these are political questions. But at the time, in 2000, when I was working on the, I worked on the committee in 2009 and 10, or for the member who was on the committee in 2009 and 10. And at the time, politics wasn't really about resource allocation and banking and corporate power. It was more about kind of symbolic questions, and had been about symbolic questions for decades, because social questions, which are important, but it kind of left political economy out. And so when this financial crisis happened and the Democrats, people who thought about questions of social justice, had not thought about political economy for 30 years, all of a sudden, there was just this sort of big question of, oh my gosh, banks seem to matter. Corporations seem to matter. What is this? And so a lot of the crisis was about learning how these systems worked and why there were certain values embedded in them. Before the crisis, we had thought, well, economists kind of know what's going on. They're a bunch of scientists, and so we should just sort of listen to the scientists. And if they say that deregulation is a good idea or mergers are a good idea, well, they're scientists. So, of course, they're being objective about it. And that was, it sounds really stupid today, but that's the way that I think a lot of people thought about the problem. So I started asking the, I'll just tell you about how the book came to be. I started during that time, I was the only people that seemed to know what was going on. The bank lobbies didn't know, Treasury, Fed, nobody knew, except for a small group of people who had essentially lost the regulatory battles of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. In particular, one woman who was on the banking committee in the 60s and 70s named Jane DeRista, and she started telling me about what was going to happen, like, oh, this market's going to blow up now, and this derivatives thing's going to blow up now. And I was like, how did you know all this? And she said, oh, well, I used to work for this guy named Wright Patman, who was a congressman that ran the banking committee in the 60s and 70s. And then a few years later, I got interested in monopoly power, and there was turns out there's a law against chain stores, which is called Robinson-Patman, that was passed in the 1930s to deal with the Walmart of its day, which was A&P, or it was also the Amazon of its day, I guess. And Wright Patman was this guy who had worked and controlled the banking committee in the 60s and 70s. And then I was like, oh, Robinson Patman, that's like the same guy. So then I started looking into this congressman that not a lot of people knew about named Wright Patman, who was in Congress from 1929 to 1976. And this whole tradition, political tradition of constraining corporate power and banking power opened up to me. And that's when I started to research it, and I was like, oh, this is a book. There's a story here about why the Democrats effectively changed how they thought about the world, and it has to do with this guy's life. He started it by impeaching the Treasury Secretary of Herbert Hoover, a guy named Andrew Mellon, who was also sort of a billionaire at the time. And he ended by getting overthrown in 1975 by Bill Clinton's generation. And so that story, and I start a little bit before that 1929, and I go a little bit after 1976. But that story of how the Democrats really fought against concentrated financial power and then how they stopped doing that is – really kind of, to me, explained why we made a bunch of bad choices during the financial crisis. So that's where the book came from.
And you also link this story to the history of what you call the rise and fall of populism. Now, populism is kind of it's an interesting term because back in decades ago when I was in college, I actually studied the populist movement, and it was a totally different idea of what populism is than what you see in the popular press these days. You seem to hearken back to the older definition of populism, the one that I had studied. Talk about this being a history as the rise and fall of populism.
Right. So populism, the original populist movement was a movement of farmers and merchants, small merchants in the 1880s and 1890s, who basically in the South and the West, who didn't like the way that railroad monopolists and banking monopolists and industrial monopolists were constraining and controlling their lives and their communities. And so they organized together into what was called the People's Party, which was the greatest third party movement in American history, with the exception, I guess, of the Republican Party in the 1850s. They organized a political movement to try to address concentrated corporate power that was emerging at that time. It was actually a multiracial movement. And they were recharacterized in the 1950s as proto-fascists. So the 1950s, a separate group of people, you know, started to who are popular historians and economists started to characterize this group that was largely frustrated at political economy questions. They started to say, oh, they actually didn't care about political economy, railroads, banks. That was all a ruse. Really, they were just Anglo-Saxons who were frustrated at immigration and. You know, they were anti-Semites, they were nativists. And that, so today when you hear populism, right, what you hear, like a lot of people associate it with Donald Trump or with authoritarian leaders all over the world, but they're actually going back to the definition that was designed in the 1950s, which actually ended up coming from the opponents of the populists of the 1880s and 90s who were largely bankers. And what I'm talking about is the actual movement, which is really just a democratic movement of people, peaceful people, who didn't like concentrated financial power. When I talk about populism, that's what I refer to. And people like Wright Patman and Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Emanuel Seller and just a whole host of political leaders who were in favor of both economic and social justice, they had learned from the populists and that populist tradition, and they used that tradition to implement policies. Louis Brandeis was very influenced by the populists. He was important in terms of structuring the New Deal. Kind of a lot of what we think of as the middle class in the 20th century, in the middle of the 20th century, the egalitarianism of that era. And it was a, you know, there was strong racial hierarchies there, but within the white middle class, there was egalitarianism. And then the, it did enable the civil rights movement. It did enable a whole series of movements, this platform for equality and getting rid of corporate power. That, that came from the populace. That came from these farmers who, you know, came from the, they took sort of a Jeffersonian approach to political economy. So that's what I mean. But then, of course, when you hear populism today, it's largely the characterization of the enemies of those people who gained new strength in the 1950s, largely weirdly on the left.
If you've just joined us, if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Matt Stoller about monopoly power and democracy. His book is Goliath. What I also learned about populism is not only that it was a coalition of farmers, black and white farmers, that was then opposed by the rise of the Klan, but also a coalition between workers and farmers. There was a farmer labor coalition between the Knights of Labor at the time and in the People's Party and elsewhere. So I wonder if you could talk about the labor movement as part of this push for populist democracy.
Right. So there was a big battle. I mean, this was what the populace couldn't figure out how to do and ultimately didn't manage to figure out was how do you unify urban workers with rural with farmers? And this is the Knights of Labor where there was a competition between the Knights of Labor and the Samuel Gompers and the AFL about what shape the labor union would take. And the Knights of Labor were much more egalitarian and democratic. And the AFL was much more guild oriented. Samuel Gompers he was much more about like having specialists. He wanted in sort of an aristocracy of labor, whereas the Knights of Labor let anyone in except for you couldn't be a lawyer. You couldn't be a banker, but they basically were just like, it was much more about, it was much more political. Gompers was very much he was pretty anti-populist in how he thought about the world. The AFL until the 1930s was a pretty reactionary force. And then they were challenged by the mine workers and the CIO, and they became much more, the AFL actually very much opposed early New Deal initiatives, really opposed it. It's sort of really, really interesting. And you read the hearings from the 1932 when the depths of the economic collapse, and you basically can't tell the difference between the testimony of the Chamber of Commerce and the testimony of the head of the AFL. They're both like, we need to cut deficits. We need, you know, it's really, you know, government has no role in this. It's just crazy. But anyway, what happened in the 1890s is you saw this massive depression in rural areas starting in 1893. And then you also saw it was Andrew Carnegie and Henry Clay Frick who destroyed the organizing in the steel industry in the Homestead Strike in 1892. And the question was, okay, what's going to happen in 1896? Because you have this huge depression. You have labor that's in urban areas that's being screwed. And at the same time, you also have this massive formation of corporate America because J.P. Morgan, that's when he structures most of corporate America, which is, you know, that's when General Electric, Westinghouse, it's when you have International Harvester. You see like roll-ups of industries throughout America. U.S. Steel is 1901. And so the 1896 election is really important. And it's in the election is William Jennings Bryan. That's when the great commoner, he's sort of the populist and the Democrat, and he gets crushed. And it's because the urban workers, effectively, they vote for the Republicans, and whereas William Jennings Bryan is able to bring the rural vote, he can never sort of get the urban vote, and that sort of sets the stage for the consolidation of corporate America into what it is today, which is the very big businesses that roll up huge swaths of the economy. So U.S. Steel, I think, was, you know, thousands of iron and steel companies get rolled up into one giant company that essentially organizes the American steel industry. So that's the setup for the 20th century. And in 1912, you have an election which is about corporate monopoly power. because that's the big question. You have this big roll-up that happens in the late 1890s and early 1900s, and it causes lots of serious political problems in the early 1900s. And finally, you have this election in 1912. And this fight, by the way, of how do you manage industrial power with, you know, railroads and coal and new forms of explosives and telegraph and telephone, things like that, this is going on all over the world. And there are different political solutions to this. Like, what do you do about it? And in America, we had the great debate was between Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson and William Howard Taft and Eugene Debs. And that was 1912. And you had Teddy Roosevelt and Eugene Debs were on one side. They wanted monopoly power, even though Teddy Roosevelt is sort of seen as a trust buster. That's actually more of a myth. He wanted to get rid of antitrust laws, and he wanted monopoly power. He just wanted the state to run them. Eugene Debs was a socialist who wanted to nationalize the means of production and wanted the state to run monopolies. Both of them thought monopolies were natural. And then you had William Howard Taft, who was basically wanted to allow for private monopolies but didn't want the government to touch them. He wanted a little bit of antitrust here or there. And then you had Woodrow Wilson, and Woodrow Wilson was heavily influenced by Louis Brandeis, and his view was, we shouldn't have monopolies. What we should have is what's called regulated competition. So you break up monopolies, which are not natural at all, and then you regulate the markets. You have rules in markets. So you have competitive markets that don't sort of drive a race to the bottom. And Woodrow Wilson ends up winning. He creates the Federal Reserve. He creates the Federal Trade Commission. He passes the Clayton Act against mergers. He does the first ban against child labor, farm supports. Really kind of the first 18 months of the Wilson administration is more impressive than the New Deal. And then it gets interrupted by World War I. And so I go over, and World War I is catastrophic for all sorts of reasons in America. And then you have this really scary decade with the Roaring Twenties. And this is kind of when my book starts with the election of 1912 and that debate, because all the people that came out, right, Patman was, and FDR and all these people came out of the Wilson ethos. They all looked up to Wilson and they thought that Wilson's, vision of how to address, and Brandeis too. I mean, but they these guys were friends with Brandeis actually. But they looked up to that attack on corporate power as sort of their model. And so the book starts, and then I go into Andrew Mellon in the 1920s and how he was a corporatist in a decade where you saw fascism emerging all over the world. And then the 1930s, the breaking of Mellon. So I look at the New Deal as a gang fight between the populists and the robber barons as fascism is rising in Germany and Japan. So there's these other models for how to do things. And so, yeah, so the first half of the book is basically the rise of corporate power and then how the populist influenced policymakers ended up winning and building a middle-class society and defeating the Nazis using the tools that they had developed to decentralize corporate power. It's a new vision of the New Deal. It's a retelling of the New Deal, but in a different way.
And it is really interesting. Let me stop you there, though, because there's a lot to cover there. And there are a couple of themes that were very interesting to me in the book. I think until recently, democracy and capitalism had been seen to be almost synonymous, but more and more an anti-capitalist critique has been building where the two are seen as inimical to each other. Woodrow Wilson is really kind of a very contradictory figure in this sense, because you talk about him as a real Democrat, and yet once World War I happened, he instituted some of the most anti-democratic political, he really unleashed an anti-democratic agenda that put people in jail for being pacifists, including Eugene Debs, really shut down the First Amendment in many ways. So how do you think about, on the one hand, his real increase of the imperial presidency, and on the other hand, his espousal of a more, his antitrust agenda?
Yeah, it's a great question. So Wilson is a fascinating figure. I mean, you also can't forget he was super racist, and Teddy Roosevelt was also extraordinarily racist. It was the the early 1900s, but these guys grew up on Lost Cause Confederate history. So they had, as did Wright Patman, actually as did FDR. So they had a certain vision of how the country was put together. They had white supremacist views, racial views about racial hierarchies. Although weirdly, W.E.B. Du Bois endorsed Wilson in 1912, which was sort of an interesting dynamic there, and then quickly regretted it. But one of the things that I think really happened with Wilson is, he had strokes. I mean, I think nobody really knows when the stroke started, but Brandeis, who was friends with Wilson, noticed a significant change in Wilson's demeanor in, pretty early on in the administration. And so a lot of the really bad things that happened, which you're talking about with the, in terms of the repurposing of emergency authority during wartime to be deeply autocratic, that stuff started happening after Wilson started having strokes, and his personality really changed. And he was this insanely savvy, really effective political leader who was able to, really build, like what he did in the first 18 months of his administration was really quite extraordinary, just in terms of moving things through Congress. He broke up AT&T, he just did all of these incredible things. And then World War I started, and that really changed how he had to think about the world. But then as World War I continued, he started to get more belligerent as a person and was less flexible. And that's, I think, when people surmised that he was actually having strokes and his, smaller strokes. And then he had a massive stroke and was bedridden and not dead, but essentially couldn't run the country. And that's when his cabinet was doing things that were just, pretty insane. Now I'm not saying he did do some things, I think, during the war that were, that were really problematic. And I think he told a colleague, war is autocratic. We'll never see, a free society in our lifetimes again. And I think that's one thing that happened during World War I is there was just this massive mobilization. It was when you saw mass censorship. I mean, the government just literally had a censorship bureau that was run by a guy named George Creel. So you know, that was actually the origin of public relations. It all came out of the George Creel's shop. But I think you can't look at Wilson without seeing almost two different people. One of whom was the pre-stroke Wilson, and one of whom was the post-stroke Wilson. So a lot of his failures at the Paris conference were, I think, a result of there was just medical problems. He also got the Spanish flu, and apparently that had significant impacts on him, on his sort of personality as well. So there were some medical things that happened to Wilson. So I don't think it's actually, I think you could look at him as two different people.
Well, that's interesting. This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Matt Stoller about monopoly power and democracy. His book is Goliath. Okay, so going back then to the question of democracy and capitalism, Louis Brandeis, who is, you mentioned, and is one of the heroes of your book, he insisted that democracy could not coexist with corporate capitalism, and that's why he wanted the monopolies to be broken up. What's your sense about this? Talk about democracy and corporate capitalism, their contradictions and their coexistence.
Right. So today, I mean, I think it's very confusing to talk about capitalism. I don't generally like to talk about capitalism or socialism because to me, capitalism and socialism are just brands. There's nothing particularly coherent about either one. And so, what Brandeis thought is that when you concentrate power in the hands of a small group, whether you call it aristocracy, whether you call it, fascism, whether you call it, the banker's ethics, the divine right of kings, it's all essentially a variant of aristocracy, unaccountable concentrations of power. And that, you can be an angel or you can be a devil, and you're still, if you have a system that's structured like that, you're unlikely to deliver a stable, equitable democracy where people can be responsible and ethical citizens. And that's, what Brandeis sought was a free society where people were educated, where they had leisure time, where they had the ability to be free people and develop themselves. That's what he wanted. And he saw a world where you had corporate concentration as inimical to a society that could enable such human flourishing. And he wanted to, he didn't think that socialism, which is, when I'll use here, like communism basically is the way that they define it, sort of the Debsian nationalizing the means of production. You know, he was, Brandeis was not, was skeptical of state power. So he was not like, if you have the state take everything over, that's gonna fix it. You might just have the state become the Leviathan and be dominant. He was, for that same reason, he was opposed to the existence of corporations like U.S. Steel, which was just too big to manage and too autocratic. What he wanted was decentralized power and then regulating the business practices so that you know, it's an updating of the Madisonian checks and balances, but brought into the commercial sector so that, you know, corporations existed and were, you know, this means, they could be a means to actually enable liberty instead of a tool of oppression. So he was also very interested in things like cooperatives and employee-owned corporations, credit unions, as well as just normal stock corporations and railroad corporations. He just wanted to see lots of experimentation. He was not opposed to public ownership of utilities and things like that, but he wanted lots of experimentation to figure out what the right way to structure industries were to enable human flourishing.
That's so interesting. Yeah, so now let's move forward a bit to the New Deal, which was, you know, you've talked about Patman, and so briefly talk about his impact on the New Deal, and talk about FDR. You know, where was he coming from? You know, I've often thought that, and I think FDR said it himself, that he did the New Deal in order to save capitalism from itself, because there was, you know, huge social and labor unrest in the 1930s. You had the rise of the CIO as opposed to the AFL. So talk about the New Deal and how that came about, and link it also to the social movements that were really behind so much of the push for its necessity.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I found really interesting as I was going through some of the archives is just how afraid New Dealers were of America going fascist. They did not, I mean, FDR was afraid of that. He thought, one of the people he pointed out, Douglas MacArthur would be the man on the horse, you know, the sort of Napoleon-like figure around whom the business elite would rally to subvert democracy. Like, there was a genuine fear there. So the social movements, you know, nobody was really afraid of the U.S. going communist. Like, there were some people on the right, but that was not what the New Dealers were afraid of. The New Dealers were far more afraid of the business elite rallying and like they had in Italy or like they had in Germany and just taking over the country. So that's where the social concern was. But the New Deal, so I start my analysis of the New Deal before FDR was even the nominee. So this was in largely, so my chapter's on what's called the Bonus Army, which was the giant protest before the New Deal that laid the predicate for what the New Deal would be. And this is a bunch of World War I veterans who had been underpaid during World War I and then during the Depression, which was just catastrophic, and I go into why the Depression happened. But during World War I, you know, these guys had been underpaid and now they were poor. And they said, hey, we want our pension paid early so that we can afford to have a home or whatever we need. And they were named, it was a derogatory name that their opponents gave them, which is that they wanted a bonus for serving in the war. And so then they took that name and they called themselves the Bonus Army. And they started to protest and say, we want our bonus early. And Patman organized them, because Patman in 1929, when he got into Congress, and he was from rural Texas, and he put forward a bill that said, we want the bonus paid early. And it was ignored because the economy was pretty good and it was great in 1929. And then as the Depression got worse, the stock market crashed and it got worse, then all of a sudden there more and more veterans were like, actually, we really need this money. And so Patman started pushing the bonus bill. And then eventually there was this massive protest that emerged out of Portland, Oregon, but then all over the country, where people came to D.C., and they set up encampments. It was kind of like Occupy Wall Street. And there weren't protests in D.C. This is not a thing that happened, right? That was a post-1960s or 1950s, 1960s thing. In the 1930s, people just did not protest in D.C. And this was a major protest and a major encampment for months. People just camped out in 1932 and said, we want, you know, the bank lobbyists are getting what they want. This is sort of the people's lobby. And they were a tourist attraction, and you know, they lobbied and they kept losing the House or the Senate. And Patman was advocating for it. And then eventually Herbert Hoover, led by Douglas, you know, he had the army clear them out. And the army was led by Douglas MacArthur and Dwight D. Eisenhower and Patton, actually. And these guys went and they destroyed the encampments, burned them down through tear gas. And at first, when the Bonus Army saw the soldiers coming and marching towards them, they thought that the army was coming to pay their respects to veterans, right? And these guys all had American flags. They were, you know, they marched in formation because they were military veterans. And then MacArthur, who was just, you know, he polished his boots to a shine the day that they were doing this, just burned it all down. Some senators got tear gassed. I mean, they're burning down the American flag. I mean, it was just a nightmare in terms of PR. And at that point, when they did this, FDR saw the newspapers the next day, and he was like, well, I guess I'm not going to have to campaign to beat Hoover if I don't want to. And he ended up campaigning. But what the Bonus Army was really about was asking the government to honor a promise it had made to its soldiers. It's very much like the student debt problem today, where a lot of people who have been promised a middle-class lifestyle if they went to college instead ended up with huge amounts of debt. And they are demanding something different from their government and honoring of a promise. So the Bonus Army was what happens in America when it's not that people are poor that gets them mad. It's when they are promised something and then you have that promise is not delivered. That was the Bonus Army. And they demanded fundamentally a different relationship between the government and the people. And at that, when they made this demand, they became a hugely important force in politics. Patman rocketed to stardom, and the Congress in 1931, which was just like really pathetic. It was the Democrats had taken it over, but they were just really pathetic Democrats. But in 1933, they became probably one of the most progressive Congresses ever. And it was the same sort of the same people. There were a bunch of new members, but they had been persuaded that the government had to have a different relationship to the people and to the corporate world. So the other thing is that Andrew Mellon, who has owned, you know, several Fortune 500 companies, was this incredibly wealthy banker and was the Secretary of the Treasury since 1921 all the way to 1932. He was the guy who had opposed the bonus from the get-go. And so he was, you know, Patman, during the Bonus Army, filed articles of impeachment against Andrew Mellon. And within a couple of weeks, Mellon had been fired by Hoover. So it was one of the most, like, you know, you talk about impeachment, right? That was a remarkable kind of moment. But he didn't impeach him on some penny ante stupid thing like the Democrats did this time. It was just square political corruption and on political economy stuff. So Mellon was doing a whole bunch of corrupt things in the Treasury, like, you know, giving himself huge tax refunds. And that's what they went after him on. And it was really effective. And then for the rest of the 1930s, so then FDR had to battle really aggressively to get the primary. And then, you know, they went after Mellon with a whole bunch of laws and antitrust cases. But the rest of the 1930s I frame and I show how really the New Dealers were trying to destroy Mellon's power. And they were also trying to destroy J.P. Morgan's power and the DuPont's power and Rockefeller's power, because they understood that these were the guys that were going to finance the man on the horse, as they had in Italy, as they had in Germany. And that was the reason that they were doing what they were doing. It wasn't, you know, today we think of the New Deal as, oh, they helped form some unions, or, oh, that was really, you know, the government got bigger. Oh, but they were still racist. And it's like, no, what was happening in the 1930s is there was a gang fight between populists who were afraid of fascism rising all over the world and plutocrats that wanted to keep what they had. And that's what the New Deal was about. And then that's why it segued into a fight in World War II, when the U.S., you know, had built up its armaments industry, which required breaking Mellon's control over aluminum and steel, right? I mean, that was important. And so it's like this whole battle of political economy, this fight basically between what were, I think you could argue, proto-fascists that had had enormous power from the 1890s onward. That's what the New Deal was about. And it was there was giant protest, and it was this whole history was hidden. I didn't know anything about it before I started researching this book. And it's why when I was sitting in Congress in 2009 and 10, and I was like hearing from people about how you needed to have, you know, all these boring alphabet soup agencies, and I had no idea what they were for. And no, really nobody knew that the origin of the SEC was to prevent domestic fascism in America by regulating securities markets. It was just a very different story than I had been taught. And so this book is designed to teach people why these institutions existed in the first place. And then the second half of the book is why this whole structure that populists had created, why it fell apart. And some very sophisticated political movements are the reason for that.
Matt Stoller. We spoke with him about his book, Goliath, The 100-Year War Between Monopoly Power and Democracy. He's the author of the blog, Big. Next up, we talk with Thomas Frank about populism, real and fake. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. And find us on Facebook at Writer's Voice with Francesca Rhiannon or Twitter at Writer's Voice. And if you're listening to our podcast, please give us some love on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We hear a lot about populism these days, but as Matt Stoller and I discussed earlier, the populism that's being roundly condemned as the ideology of the right wing is a far cry from the original sense of the term that we know from American history. How did the name of such an important progressive movement get turned on its head by those who link it to right-wing racism and nationalism? Thomas Frank has been thinking about that for a long time. In 2018, he wrote a piece for The Guardian entitled, Forget Trump, Populism is the Cure, Not the Disease, and has recently come out with a book about the topic, The People Know, A Brief History of Anti-Populism. We hope to be talking with him about that book later in the season. But we actually spoke with Frank more than a year ago about the subject, so in light of our discussion with Matt Stoller, I thought I'd replay part of that conversation with Thomas Frank. I asked him to tell us about the populist movement of the 19th century.
It was a left-wing farmer movement, which sounds like there is no such thing anymore, right? There's not even a possibility for such a thing, but that's what it was. Farmers at the time were the single largest occupation, of course. It was something like 40 or 50% of the population. This is in the 1890s. I should have said at the beginning, this is in the 1890s that this happened. And in the years up till leading up to that, farmers had been – they're uniquely vulnerable to monopolies and powerful banks because farmers are a debtor class. I don't know if you know this, but they have to borrow all the time. They still do today. And they're also – because they're dispersed, you know, and there's millions of them and they're all over the country, they're vulnerable to monopoly. So railroad monopolies back in those days, today different monopolies that prey on farmers, whether you're talking about, you know, agribusiness or you're talking about Walmart. They're vulnerable to monopoly and they're vulnerable to banks. And they set up a group back then called the Farmers Alliance. It was like a farmers union, and started to come up with ways to fight back against the banks and the monopolies. And eventually they decided that they couldn't do anything until they went into politics because the political system was so firmly controlled by the banks and the monopolies. And they did. And they went into politics, and that's when they took the name the People's Party. They decided to be a third party for complicated reasons. It had to do with the North and the South. Both the two regions were single party regions, you might remember. So in one part of America, the Farmers Union, Farmers Alliance worked through the Democratic Party, and in another part they worked through the Republican Party, and they couldn't get anywhere. And they said, this is stupid. Let's start our own party. And that was the Populist Party. And they focused very, very closely on economic issues And they weren't just farmers. So they also brought in a whole lot of other reformers. There were lots of different reform movements around in the late 19th century, and they also reached out to organized labor, or not even organized, just workers in general. And in fact, they thought that there was a natural alliance between farmers and urban workers. So they, like the Knights of Labor, were part of this party and that kind of thing. And they, for a couple of years, they did really well. There was a serious depression in the early 1890s. And, you know, you might remember this is when some of the biggest, most wrenching strikes in our history took place. The Homestead Strike is one. The Pullman Strike is one. So all this stuff was going on, and the populists were on – took the side of the strikers on these things. And they were getting more and more powerful, and they were doing better and better. And then in 1896, which is sort of the climactic year, it was a presidential election that year, to everyone's enormous surprise, the Democratic Party meeting in Chicago, the Democratic Party basically embraced a part of the populist platform and fully embraced the sort of language of populism. And they wound up nominating this guy, William Jennings Bryan, who was from Nebraska, had spent a lot of time with the populists, and who talked like one. And this was an enormous shock to the nation that such a man could be nominated by one of the two major political parties. He was 36 years old. and he was apparently an amazing orator.
The golden-tongued orator, I believe he was called.
Yeah, they wouldn't use that phrase. His symbol was silver. It's funny now to think about it, but a lot of the political issues back then boiled down to this battle over whether we should have a gold standard or a silver standard, which just seems like so – you know, who can imagine caring about that, you know? But it was a big deal at the time. And so the Democrats embraced silver, and the Republicans rallied behind their champion, William McKinley, and embraced the gold standard, stood up for the gold standard. And the Republicans – this was in a lot of ways the very beginnings of sort of 20th century politics. The Democrats tried to reach out to labor. They didn't really succeed. The Republicans, meanwhile, did a great job in campaign fundraising. This is the first time anybody did anything, any kind of modern fundraising, was McKinley. And they basically buried William Jennings Bryan. They outspent him something like 30-1 by this outrageous, you know, imbalance. Bryan went around the country, you know, on a train to spread his message, because that was the cheapest way, since the newspapers were almost 100% against him. And he had to carry his own bags. That always blows me away to realize that the guy is running for president of the United States, and he's going around the country carrying his own bags. Anyhow, he lost. Long story short. And he lost, and the populists who had endorsed him, you know, they saw him as their chance, you know, their bid for national power. And they made their bid for national power, and they failed. And they fell apart basically after that, and they were never really heard from again. They declined, and then the Spanish-American War, which happened a few years later, really killed them. And that was the end of that was really the last big national third-party movement in this country. Anyhow, that was populism.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with political analyst and historian Thomas Frank about populism, real and fake. Right. And one of the key aspects of it that I always thought was important was that it united black and white farmers, at least in parts, and so different from the so-called populism of today, which is based so much on racism.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting that the definition has been completely reversed? And it's actually kind of unusual that you even know that. I speak to audiences around the country all the time, and most of them don't know. They assume that populism was a racist movement, but actually, by the standards of the day, it was an anti-racist movement. They talked a lot about — this is in the South now. In the South, you know, this terrible racist system. You know, Reconstruction has ended, but in a lot of states, blacks still had the vote at that time. They were still able to vote. And the populists, one of the way that they, you know, what they came up with is their sort of singular appeal was, we're going to represent poor blacks and poor whites. You know, there was a Farmers Alliance and there was also a Black Farmers Alliance. And so there were a lot of black populists as well. And this was an incredible revolutionary thing that they said they were going to do this and then tried to follow through on it. Now, they did not succeed. They did try. And there were some states where they succeeded, like North Carolina. They managed to win. They managed to take over the state in alliance with the Republican Party, which was black voters were mainly aligned with the Republican Party in the South at that time. And so they succeeded here and there. But by and large, they did not succeed. But it was they tried. And that's the that apparently put such a scare into the Southern ruling class in the 1890s. And a lot of people have written about this. It's a really interesting story. But the populist effort to bring together poor blacks and poor whites was so frightening to the Southern ruling class that this is when you see in a lot of states the effort to disenfranchise black voters, you know, with literacy tests and poll taxes. And, you know, the whole, you know, they used all of these different techniques to make it legal, you know. They would set up white primaries, this kind of thing. But they rallied around – they actually used the phrase white supremacy openly as a rallying cry to beat populism. You know, you can't vote for these guys. These guys are – you know – and it gets ugly. To do the research on this, it gets really ugly really fast. It's funny. I've never actually talked about this to audiences. And it's just some awful stuff. I mean, people were – they were killing each other and, you know, it's a fascinating story. And what's really fascinating is that, you know, the story itself is fascinating, but the way we have misinterpreted it over the years is also fascinating. Where today – I mean, the New York Times, the, you know, leading newspaper of the English-speaking world, uses the word populist as a synonym for racist.
Right. And, you know, you call this populism's evil right-wing doppelganger. I mean, to me, when Trump got elected and I first started hearing the word populism being bandied around, it drove me up a wall because I actually, like you, I studied the history of populism in this country and had a completely different idea of what it is. So talk about how did this faux populism first arise in the modern political era?
So this is also – this is a story that does not begin with Trump. It begins in the 60s with the governor of Alabama, George Wallace, who was the great sort of foe of the civil rights movement. You know, he was the – you know, that was his police that were beating up protesters in Birmingham, et cetera, et cetera. His police on the bridge at Selma. He's the one that stood in the – famously stood in the schoolhouse door at was it the University of Alabama? I don't remember the particulars, but he was a famous opponent of the civil rights movement. And in 1968, he decided that he needed to run for president, and he did it in kind of an interesting way. This is the beginning of the culture wars. Was in the late 60s, and Wallace was really kind of an inventive guy, came up with all of these ways of expressing his frustration and anger with hippies, protesters, university professors, liberals in general. You know, now you remember it's not just the civil rights movement at the time, it's also the Vietnam War is going on, and so there's protests everywhere. Oh, and he also, of course, hated the news media. So you know how Trump likes to call out the news media in his rallies. He's lifting that directly from Wallace. In fact, so the Wallace sort of pioneered what we think of today as the culture wars. And the Nixon campaign, the Nixon people were watching him in 1968. And here's another interesting thing: Wallace was a Democrat. And so Wallace had run in Democratic primaries, then ran as an independent in 1968. But he took away a lot of Democratic votes from Humphrey, and he also took away Republican votes. But basically, once the election was over, Nixon said, "You know, this is the key. to the politics of the future. They called it the Southern Strategy, that the Republican Party would basically steal Wallace's approach and use that as a way of flipping the South from being Democratic to being Republican. And Francesca, that strategy worked. And that's sort of the beginning of it, of the culture wars and all that. Now, it didn't get attached to right-wing economic doctrine until a little later. You know, you had Reagan come along in the early 1980s. And eventually what you see happening – and this is – by the way, I say this is the subject of my lifetime, you know, because I've written about it so many times, is what's the matter with Kansas is about. The right understood the power of this kind of populist approach by which – a fake populist approach, by which I mean they talked like working class people. They talk about culture war issues from a working class perspective, and yet they where they stand on the issues is always just remorselessly pro-corporate, pro-big corporations. And Trump furnishes the – you know, the perfect example. They called him the blue-collar billionaire at the Republican convention. And as I wrote at the time, it wasn't just his sort of his way of talking that earned him that title. He also was the man talked about the trade deals over the years that have been very, you know, that have really hurt working-class people. And he talked about these in a what appeared to be at first a very sympathetic manner. Now, he gets elected president. What's the first and basically the only thing he's managed to accomplish? Gigantic tax cuts and also deregulation, although he hasn't done that through Congress. He's done that through all of these executive actions, you know, all the this massive deregulation that he has done. He's done incredible favors for the corporate world. Now, these blue-collar voters – who fell for his act, you know, what's left for them? Well, I mean, look, unemployment is extremely low, and that means that wages have been going up. But that's not because Trump really cares about them or Trump has done anything for them. That's just a side effect of the economy running so hot, you know. But anyhow, Trump is a perfect case. But Reagan before him was also a perfect case, and so was George W. Bush. And we forget that all of these guys all of these guys campaigned in the same way, tried to show their solidarity with middle America by using culture war issues. They would do anything for the working class as long as it didn't involve money, as long as it didn't involve anything real, you know? And that's also the story with my home state of Kansas, which swung wildly to the right in the 1980s and 1990s. You know, when I was growing up, it's always been a Republican state, but it was a different kind of Republican. It was a moderate to liberal kind of Republican.
It used to have great schools, for example, Kansas.
I went to them. I know that. And Nancy Kassebaum was our senator, one of the last liberal Republicans. You know, Alf Landon was who was the governor who ran against Roosevelt in 1936. People don't know this, but he was actually in his heart was kind of a very liberal Republican. Dwight D. Eisenhower was from there. That was the sort of classic Kansas personality, political personality type. And all of a sudden in the 90s, those people started losing and were being replaced with this kind of Sam Brownback type, this very conservative, arch-conservative Republicans. And so the question of what's the matter with Kansas is how the hell did that happen? And it was the same thing. It was Republicans, or I should say the far right, figuring out how to use populist language while not meaning a word of it. And in the case of Kansas, the main issue that they did this with was the abortion issue. But there were several others. There was the theory of evolution. Jesus. Do you remember this? This is where the book started. This was the germ of it all. I was in Chicago. You know, I lived in Chicago at the time, and I was reading the newspaper one day, and there's this story about Kansas going to war against the theory of evolution, my home state. And I couldn't believe it. I was so ashamed. And I decided right then and there that I had to investigate. But all these roads lead back to populism, to these opportunistic right-wing politicians using populist language to win election.
I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and this is Writer's Voice. I'm talking with Thomas Frank about populism and about how the term has been appropriated by those who tie it to racism and nationalism instead of the biracial fight for economic justice the original populist movement in the U.S. promoted. Do you think it would have been as easy for them to pull the wool over working class voters' eyes if it hadn't been linked to the kind of right-wing cultural shift that you're talking about here with racism, but also, you know, the wars against women's health?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mentioned the abortion issue, but racism is a huge part of this. Like I said, that's really where it began, you know, with George Wallace and the backlash against the civil rights movement. Now, what fascinated me about the Kansas story is that it wasn't a big part of the story there. That what makes the Kansas story significant is that it shows how this stuff can be, this right-wing populism can be secularized, if you will, can be taken away from the sort of its racist roots and become something else. But with Trump, you see, oh yeah, you see the racism and the bigotry in an enormous way.
Thomas Frank. He's the author of the recent book, The People Know, A Brief History of Anti-Populism, and many other books. He's also the founder and editor of the journal The Baffler. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.